When we moved here, it was a farm. It had been a working farm, and there was a lot of barns, the old farmhouse. The whole front of the property had been cleared, but we had beautiful forest in the back, which we loved, a beautiful pond, beautiful forest. But I really wanted the forest to be everywhere. I really wanted forest coming right up to the road. So in 2010, we planted 500 Norway spruce seedlings. We had a big work party. There was a whole bunch of us, and we just planted all these seedlings all across the front of the property. And then it was a pretty dry year, and the year after was a pretty dry year. We tried hard to water, but we have a lot of drought in this area. And I would say now, 15 years later, probably less than 10% of the trees have survived, especially at the front. Very few of the ones at the front have survived. So what we've been doing is doing some replanting, particularly on the one side. We've been finding trees in the forest, and the charity has purchased some cedar trees, and we now have what we call the cedar loop, but it's got a mix of, it's still got a few of the spruce left from 15 years ago, plus some pines, a whole lot of cedars, and some lilacs. And just recently, Ayamedanandi has been, she's an artist. And she's a stone artist. And what she's been doing is, because we've had a number of people who are close to our community who have had friends or family members that have passed away, she's painted the names, the first name of these people, and it's been placed at a tree. And so last night I was doing my loop. I like to walk on that loop, and I was contemplating. And I was looking at all the names that are on these stones. And there is one of our very close supporters. There's the name of his parents. His mom died a couple of years ago, and his dad before that. And we have another stone for somebody's father who died. They were quite young. They were in their 20s, and their father had he was just over 60, and he died. His death anniversary, I think, was just last week. And we had somebody whose brother just passed away less than a month ago. And somebody whose sister passed away. It was one of our original trees. She passed away the year we moved in here. So I think about 16 years ago. And then we have a tree for somebody whose husband passed away last year. And we have two trees for dear friends and supporters whose sons have passed away. One passed away tragically last year, and the other also very tragically, maybe 3 years ago. And then we have a tree that's just been dedicated to a little baby that passed away. We don't know the baby, and we don't know the baby's mom, but we know a friend of the baby's mom. And we also even have a stone for a little unborn baby that didn't make it. And it's powerful. When I walk around and I look at all the stones, it's a powerful reflection. The names don't mean that much to me. They mean something to me in that some of them I know, but some of them I don't know. But it's a powerful reflection on what do we all have in common. These are parents, siblings, spouses, children, babies. And they've all passed away. And it's a very powerful reminder of the nature of reality. And this is something the Buddha wanted us to seriously reflect upon. And I think it's a topic that sometimes people don't want to hear about or don't want to discuss, reflecting on old age, sickness, and death. Maybe it seems depressing. Maybe it seems, I'm not sure, scary, something that we fear. But I came to this Buddhist teaching, was so inspired by this Buddhist teaching, and became a nun because I learned about the Buddhist teaching and I heard there was this great being who didn't have a fear of death, who was fearless. And that was very inspiring to me because I was just so terrified of death. And not so much old age, maybe old age, but sickness. You know, I think when I was young, it maybe seemed, well, it's not going to happen to me, but it does happen to us and it happens to everyone. And it, for me, these stones are that perfect reminder, but I'm sure everyone has someone in their life who has died before their time or who's gotten an illness. We have this regularly, our supporters sharing their stories with us, and some of them are really tragic stories. And it's interesting to see how everyone deals with nature and what happens in nature, this old age, sickness, and death, how we all respond to it or react to it, whether it's happening to us or whether it's happening to our friends. But the Buddha encourages us every day to reflect on these five subjects. I am of the nature to age. I am of the nature to sicken. I am of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise. I am the owner of my kamma, heir to my kamma, born of my kamma, related to my kamma. Whatever kamma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So what do we do with this? What we reflect on this. So look within yourself. If you're reflecting on this, where do you go with that? Is it just some sort of resignation? Or does it inspire you to see that putting your refuge in the body is just going to lead to suffering? And what the Buddha is suggesting is that we need to look elsewhere for our refuge. Look beyond the world with this body for our refuge. It was interesting. Janice mentioned something to me. It was a suggestion for a discussion that had been going on with a Dhamma, I think with the TBC Dhamma group. And it was just, it was a question of words, using certain words for one thing and certain words for another thing. Or two phrases, and how do they differentiate, or what's the same? But then we have some supporters who are coming, and they have a young friend who's dying. And I think when that's happening, the words go out the window, don't they? The words aren't nearly as important as, where's our refuge right here and now? Because the words are just all created, aren't they? Words are just conditioned. Language is just a created phenomena. And we use it to the best of our ability to describe things. But eventually we have to go beyond that. And we can't get lost in it. We can't get lost in the views and opinions. Because that's just another way of hanging on to this creation, this body-mind creation. And we need to seriously remind ourselves that this is not a safe refuge. The body is not a safe refuge. We chanted at the beginning of this session, I take refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. And then I think a lot of people, I was mentioning this to somebody earlier today, and they said, well, can you talk? I always get confused about what refuge is. What does it mean? What does real refuge mean? I need to understand this. What does refuge mean? Does it mean that I should just pretend like the body's not mine, or just like, how do I do it? How do I take refuge out of the body? Because this body really, all we've ever known as humans is that this body is ours. And this thinking mind and these emotions are ours. Is this true? This is how we've all been conditioned. So when we take refuge in Buddha, do you know this word Buddha? It means knowing. We say that this being that we praise and chant appreciation for, he was Samma Sambuddha. He was an all-knowing being. And he, over time, became the Buddha. We called him a Buddha. He was an all-knowing being. But knowing isn't just for Buddhas. We all have the capacity to know and understand reality just as it is. Dhamma is the nature of reality. It's the true nature of things. That's what all these teachings, well, you could say, well, the Dhamma is all these books with the suttas and the Vinaya, but those are just the directional signs. That's leading, trying to lead us. We don't get lost in the signs. It's like when somebody's pointing to the moon, you don't look at the finger, you look at the moon. And it's the same with the teachings. What are the teachings pointing to? And it's very hard when a teaching is pointing to something that's not describable. So they're just directional signs, and we have to see them that way and not get lost in them, not cling to them. And when we take refuge in the Sangha is the beings who have awakened to this over the centuries and who have been able to carry on these teachings for all of us to appreciate here and now. So the Buddha teaches us that our true refuge is in the knowing, the pure knowing, or the pure awareness, or the pure consciousness, whatever you want to pick, whatever words. You can discuss if they're different or if they're the same. It doesn't matter because it's what you're pointing to. And it's right here and right now. You're all conscious. Is there anyone here who's not conscious? That would be a shocker. I don't know how you would have turned on the computer then or gotten to the Carrot Common if you're not conscious. We're all conscious. There's consciousness. You're aware, you're conscious. Are you aware you're conscious? You're aware. You're aware. There's consciousness. Consciousness is here and now all the time. Knowing is here and now all the time. I'm speaking, and I'm aware I'm speaking. You're listening, hopefully, and you're aware that you're listening. You're aware you're listening, you're aware of the words coming in, you're perhaps aware of a commentary, maybe you're trying to understand what I'm saying, maybe you're confused, but there's an awareness of that. Maybe your body, there's a feeling of pain in the body, and you're aware of that, and that's a focus of your attention. This is what awareness is, just that. Awareness is being aware right here and now of what's going on. It's aware, and from the introduction in Buddhism, we are encouraged to just get used to being with awareness. So the Buddha says, be aware of your body. Be aware of, are you sitting? Be aware of the feeling of the pressure. of, say, your legs, or if you're sitting on the floor, your feet on the floor, your legs, be aware of your hands resting on your lap. Be aware of the body. This is awareness in the present moment. Be aware of where your body is in space and what feelings are in your body. Be aware of your mind states. Be aware of emotions. Be aware of thoughts. This is the training. The training is to keep coming back to awareness. Because as humans, we learn very quickly that we can do a lot of things and not be aware. And sometimes you weren't, maybe when you were turning off the light, you were lost in a thought. This happens all the time to all of us. So then we learn we need to purify. And then we say, well, how do I purify awareness? How do I purify consciousness? And this is the important thing. And purifying awareness, purifying consciousness means learning to see the conditioned habits of the body and the mind and how they infuse themselves in awareness. What do I mean? So the mind does it continuously all day long. So I'm aware of, I'm sitting on the chair and my conditioning will say, this is comfortable, this is not comfortable. The screen is too big, the screen is too small. This is the conditioning. The conditioning is what we layer on top of the awareness. It's the opinions, it's the views, it's the preferences, it's the desires. It's the becoming, wanting things to be different in the future. It's the being convinced that the consciousness, the awareness, is maybe in here, somewhere inside of me. It's my consciousness, my awareness, me, me, me. That's the conditioning. It's like a poison is infusing. It's just entangled in there. It's so difficult to clear it. That's the job. That's the practice. And the Buddha describes these four kinds of toxicities. One of them is the basic toxicity of ignorance, of identification with this body mind as an ego individual. The second one is the toxicity of sense desire. Continually getting lost in sense desire, feeling like happiness will only come if I'm having another pleasant experience and another pleasant experience. What it's doing is meaning that you're becoming very dependent on experiences for your happiness. There's the toxicity of becoming. Like I need to be something different in the future, or my children need to be something different in the future. I need to become a better Dhamma practitioner. I need to get enlightenment. That's the toxicity of becoming. And then there's the toxicity of views and opinions. That's where we get completely lost in our preferences, our understanding of the world. Even though we know views and opinions change all the time, we learn them from somebody else. We weren't born with views and opinions, were we? This is something we've heard from other people, and if, in the beginning it's our parents, it's our siblings, it's our school, it's our society. We get infused with views and opinions. My political system is better than yours, my country is better than yours, and we will fight to the death over these, over views and opinions. So the Buddha puts views and opinions in with these toxicities, creating this suffering, this ego identification and the craving and the clinging that go along with it. So that is what is separating us from pure awareness, from freedom from suffering. That's it. It's not like we have to get anything. Pure awareness is here. It's just we layer on top of it with the ego creation, with a wanting, with a desire for things to be different. And it's a strong pull. It's a very, very strong pull. When we meditate, we say, okay, I don't need the sense desires. I'm happy to turn off the sense desires for this hour-long sit or 45-minute long sit, whatever it is. You make that determination at the beginning. I'm here, and I'm here to be aware. I'm here to abide in pure awareness. I'm here to see what arises. Maybe nothing arises. Maybe it's completely peaceful. Just stillness. But because of our conditioning of our mind, eventually something will arise. And the body. The body can't stay still for forever. Pains arise in the body. Stiffness arises in the body. And it's the same with the mind. Thoughts start to arise in the mind. And maybe emotions come up. Maybe stories come up. Maybe planning. Maybe you've got a busy afternoon after this, and you're already starting to think, what am I going to do? What am I going to do next? Or maybe a memory is coming up and you're lost in the memory. As soon as you realize it, as soon as you realize you're lost in something, you come back to the present moment. And you start again. Because this practice is all about present moment. There's no need to be hard on yourself. There's no need to judge where you're at. Just come back to the present moment. And I like to remind myself the present moment is peaceful. Silence is peaceful. The habit of the mind will be to get bored with silence. The habit of the mind is restlessness. But the more you practice, it's just like any habit, the more you practice and the more you don't follow after it, the less power it has over you. And when we can sit and meditate and learn to pay attention, and what are we paying attention to? We're paying attention to what's arising in the mind. What's arising in the body, and just as importantly, or more importantly, the story we are creating, the me and mine that we create so quickly around whatever's arising. That's where we have to catch it. We have to catch that story that's arising, that me and mine that's arising, that becoming, that craving that's arising. And we have to just see that's arising. Why is it arising? It's arising because of conditioning, because that's what we've been trained to do. You have to be compassionate. Pure awareness is compassion. It's love. It's not like you have to create compassion or you have to create love. That's the true nature of pure awareness. Because you're able to let go of the ego, and it's the ego that's stopping love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. It's the ego, the toxic ego, that's getting in the way. And then you can just see. So does awareness mean that? So these people, I think about all the people who know these beloved friends or family members, children who have passed away. Does pure awareness mean grief doesn't arise? No, it doesn't mean grief doesn't arise. But it means that we can sit with the grief. We can be with the grief. We can see grief because it's normal to have grief. I think about when my parents passing. And sometimes it comes up very strong. There'll be a smell or a sound or taste, and it brings up very strongly my parents. And sometimes grief arises. I don't need to get upset about that. I don't need to. There doesn't have to be a problem with it. There's the awareness, though, this is arising. This is arising because of conditioning. That's the awareness with Dhamma in the mind. Awareness with Dhamma means I see the impermanent nature of our feelings. And I should just say of feelings. The impermanent nature of thoughts. The impermanent nature of views and opinions. And the impermanent nature of the body. We think that the pure awareness, we need to have the body and we need to have sensory experience to have pure awareness. But what happens when we sleep? When we sleep, we're no longer taking in input from any of our senses, are we? Eyes are closed. We're not. We're no longer doing that. And yet consciousness will still go, we know, through our dreams. It does a whole mishmash, doesn't it, of memories and perceptions and thoughts. That's coming up in our dreams. So pure consciousness, most of us, how we experience consciousness is through the body right now. But when we sit and meditate, we start to realize pure consciousness is not dependent on the body. And there's a refuge in that, and there's a freedom in that. And it's accessible to all of us, even if it's just for a moment. It's a moment of freedom. And then maybe we get lost in the ego again. But we keep coming back. We keep having to remind ourselves, I am not this body. I am not this conglomerate of thoughts and emotions. These are just habits. These are just conditioned. These have been fed to me, fed into this system. It's like a giant AI, but a giant AI doesn't have pure consciousness. Because a pure consciousness is what's beyond all conditioning. And then we don't need the world to be a certain way for contentment to arise. It doesn't mean preferences aren't going to arise, because preferences are conditioned. I think what confuses people is they think I thought I had to get rid of all my preferences. I thought I had to start liking a food I never liked my whole life, or something like that. Or I could start to eat spicy food when I never could eat spicy food. But these are just preferences, these are just conditions of the body and the mind. It's being able to see that pure awareness, being able to see preferences with awareness, and seeing I am not my preference. I am the pure awareness that just sees preferences and just knows the true nature of preferences. The true nature of preferences, they arise and cease. They're not stable. They're not personal. They're because of conditioning. If I cling to them, I'm going to suffer. Then what happens when a preference arises? The sting of preferences is not so strong. Even as you're practicing, even when you can do this a little bit, you start to see the sting of life not so strong. We don't get so lost in the lows. No, we don't get so lost in the highs. It's like riding the waves. Riding the waves of the mind, riding the waves of the body. But it's not a complacency, because when abiding in pure awareness, it's a freedom. There's a freedom there. There's a peace there. There's a natural lightness and love there. So try not to think of this as something I can't imagine, because the I can't imagine is the thinking mind. In every moment, see the awareness that sees what's arising in it. Like right now, what's arising right now, whether it's a thought, just hearing the voice, whether there's opinions or questions coming up, confusion. The awareness just sees it. They're two separate things. There's the awareness, and then there's the conditioned mind and the conditioned body arising and ceasing. Even just a moment of seeing that is a disentangling. It's a moment of disentangling. It's a moment of cleaning the toxin out. And that's what we keep doing. That's the foundation of the practice. Sometimes when we're meditating, we're so lost in our busyness and our distraction. We need something to anchor us to the present moment. So one of the best anchors is the breath. Just focusing on the in-breath, focusing on the out-breath. We're not trying to change the breath. We're not trying to modify it, but we're just using it as an anchor to keep us in the present moment. But sometimes the breath, if the mind is really restless, it won't even stay with that. So then I think a mantra is really good to help anchor us to the present moment, to anchor us to awareness of arising and ceasing. And there's a couple of mantras that I like. One is Budo. Budo. And you can connect it with the breath too. You can do Bud on the in-breath and Do on the out-breath. Budo. And why I like Budo is because Budo is like Buddha and it means knowing. So when you use Budo as an anchor, it's like you're saying knowing, 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 awareness. It's pure and simple, knowing. And another one, you know, maybe something's coming up in the mind. Maybe there's a lot of ill will or anger coming up in the mind. You could use a mantra like on the in-breath, love, and on the out-breath, peace. That's another one I like. Just to anchor. If you're finding that just staying in pure, abiding in pure awareness is just too difficult, use a support. And then eventually the support, you won't feel you need it so much. And it might just drop away on its own. Eventually the knowing knows without the Buddha. I use the sound of silence too. That one's a really handy one for me. I learned that one. It's funny, I learned it. I heard about it early on before I was even a nun, but I couldn't connect to it. I didn't really appreciate how to use it. But then later on, I started to use it more when I was in Vancouver, actually. I started to use it more, and I could see I used it sort of as a way to open awareness up, because the sound of silence, for me, it's always there. If nothing else is coming up, maybe it can get quite loud, or it's just there. I always think of it like grace. It's grace. It's my connection.